Many of you were present last month at the congregation's town hall, where we reviewed the recommendations from the Integrated Justice Team. The Integrated Justice Team, with France Giddings, Fran Wesling, and Ellie Peterson and myself, formed last year under a mandate from our Board of Trustees, directing us to examine how we might integrate our values of being multicultural, anti-racist, and anti-oppressive into the way we conduct our business, worship, and our programs. There's a recognition in that it is not simply enough to proclaim our values. We must find ways to incorporate them into our systems. One of the recommendations from the Integrated Justice Team is that we specifically address the reason why restoration and reparation are a core component of addressing racial justice. And that's the impetus of this sermon today. Ta-Nehisi Coates, in the Atlantic magazine titled The Case for Reparation, writes these words. American prosperity was built on 2.5 centuries of slavery, a deep wound that has never been healed or fully atoned for. And that has been deepened by years of discrimination, segregation, and racist housing policies that persist to this day. Until America reckons with the moral debt it has accrued and the practical damage it has done to generations of Black Americans, it will fail to live up to its own ideals. America begins in Black plunder and white democracy, two features that are not contradictory, but complementary. The men who came together to found the independent United States, dedicated to freedom and equality, either held slaves or were willing to join hands with those who did. None of them felt entirely comfortable about the fact, but neither did they feel responsible for it. That's the end of his quote. Reparations are a form of compensation for past injuries. We have seen countries do this work before. In West Germany, in 1952, they began the work of making amends for the Holocaust, despite the rigid opposition of both Germans and Jews to this path of reparation. South Africa, committed itself to repairing the racially torn country after apartheid ended, with the Truth and the Reconciliation Commission. Here in the United States, in 1994, Florida paid $2.1 million to the descendants of African-American victims of the 1923 Rosewood Massacre. And the Tulsa Race Riot Commission recommended reparations be paid to the survivors of the 1921 riots that left over 300 African-Americans murdered. In 1988, the Civil Liberties Act paid $20,000 to each Japanese American who was incarcerated during World War II. And we are currently dealing with hundreds of demands for reparations from the indigenous people for crimes such as the abuse of students in parochial and government-run schools. This is work that has been done before. In regard to African American and Native American populations, we can't simply base reparations on past injuries because we have compounded the original injustice by decades of segregation, unfair housing and employment practices, and active discrimination. For instance, the destructive legacy of slavery continues to hinder many African Americans from achieving equal status in this society. We see this in measurable ways, such as high infant mortality rates, high unemployment, and high incarceration rates. Despite our efforts to address racism in our society, it persists. There's an enduring racial divide, and even though there's a general abhorrence for blatant expressions of bigotry, there is a persistent remoteness and distrust found in places of work, education, and worship. Slavery's legacy lives on. It has created structural systems that have put African Americans at a disadvantage. Unfair housing practices, government support, and financial loans have resulted in large economic discrepancies. While 4% of white children are raised in poor neighborhoods, 62% of black children are raised in poor neighborhoods. And black families have less accumulated wealth, largely due to this legacy of discrimination. And this means that there is no safety net when a medical emergency, divorce, or job loss happens. Some argue that the way to change this for the United States is for the United States government to pay reparation money to the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of slaves, an act that would not only acknowledge the harm that slavery inflicted, but would also force white Americans to do more than just pay lip service to the crime of slavery and the structures of racism. Others argue that monetary settlements to individuals won't solve the problem. Instead, the U.S. budget needs to allocate a percentage to improving schools and job trainings, programs, and social support systems, a political and social settlement. Still, others point out that a demand for reparation raises issues that cannot be resolved by courts or legislation, issues involving human relationships. The real change of heart that is needed to end racism cannot come about through legislation. Victoria Barnett, who wrote the article Racism, Reparations, and Accountable, writes this: slavery was not perpetrated by just traders and slaveholders. It created patterns of complicity that extended through U.S. society and still affect each one of us. Complicity in such cases does not consist of a singular sin. It becomes an ongoing pattern of individual behavior that is interwoven with predominant social patterns. In the long term, complicity is about the continued social effects of individual and communal misdeeds. It is this ongoing aspect of complicity that makes reparations and all attempts at apology, restitution, reconciliation, or forgiveness so complex and so controversial. When injustice is perpetrated against an entire group, when it persists over a long period of time, and its effects permeate society, no one is untouched. The dividing lines that result, religious, ethnic, economic, warp private and public lives. The longer such dividing lines exist, the more difficult it is to have genuine and honest dialogue between those on opposite sides. Even the best-intended attempts to change the situation remain part of a much greater process that steadily undermines them. The enduring moral paralysis, rationalization, and defensiveness hinder us from going any further. This is why individual attempts to address the racial divide in this country so often hit a stone wall. We are confronting a social sin, and the problem and its possible solutions cannot be addressed apart from the larger issues. We're faced with problems and questions that define the foundation of our morals and our values. Can individuals be held accountable for the acts of their forebears? Are later generations accountable for the acts of their, Can individuals be held accountable for social and political injustices that happen on a massive scale? Are later generations accountable for the acts of their forebears? Is it possible to address past injustices and the subsequent legacy in ways that feel legitimate and fair, in ways that are adequate to all those involved, even those coming from different political viewpoints? What amount of money could ever compensate victims who have been tortured, who have lost family members, or forcibly deprived of their homes and livelihood? Well, this has been done somewhat to the interned Japanese Americans in an issue like slavery. What kind of compensation is due? And who is liable? We can no longer bring slave owners and traders to justice. Yet the legacy of their crimes continues to benefit those who interacted with the power and privileges that emerged from that injustice. And what has this got to do with church? Why would this political issue be addressed in a religious institution? It's because the process of restitution and reparation requires ongoing reflection about the moral nature of how we confront the past and how we move into the future. Religious communities form the moral voice and impetus to think about such things as our legacy of racism. It was the religious people of South Africa who brought the questions to the public sphere, forming the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, allowing genuine conversations to happen. It is the work of our religious faith to provide the moral voice here. The foundations of our country rest on the original sin of slavery and genocide. Until we adequately address this, talk about this, and create some sort of path of reconciliation, racism will persistently tear at our moral fiber. We are the ones who will persist in speaking the truth about racism and reconciliation. We are the ones who will insist on real conversations that include all voices. And we are the ones that insist that all our history be acknowledged, that we do not refuse to identify the role that our ancestors played in oppression or genocide, that we do not silence victims' voices, that we do not deny that injustice has happened. Gregory Boyd spoke here a few weeks ago. He preached out that love is the center of our faith, of this faith. We have our eight principles that call us to seek truth, that affirm justice, equity, and compassion, that acknowledge the inherent worth of each person. All these principles are informed by our abiding love that compels us to be in healthy, growing relationship with each other. And this expands outside the walls of this room, of this building. It extends to the margins where we have placed the voices of those we have disenfranchised and harmed. The work of centering the lives, those lives, is the work of love. The work of reconciliation and restoration is the work of love. And if we declare that love is at the center of our lives and at the center of our church, then we are the ones who must do this work of repairing the damage to this country's moral fiber. Blessed be.